I'm Phil C.
And I'm Lynn.
And together, we're Roman Oz. Real interviews.
With real people.
On location.
With a great mix of Aussie music.
As requested by the people we interview.
Follow us on Facebook.
Or check us out, allaussieradio.com.au.
Now syndicated too.
Backwater Country, 87.6 FM.
Tuesdays and Fridays.
At 9 p.m. All interviews are live.
And on location.
And may vary in audio quality from segment to segment.
So, Phil, what's on the show this week?
Oh, well, Lynn, you're going to be telling us all about things to do and see in the Tumut area.
That's right, and you're going to be chatting to Robert Richards at the Tumut Broom Factory.
Right.
And then Tim Martin at the Tuma River Brewing Company.
A brewing company?
Yeah, that sounds exciting.
Sounds like my sort of thing, a brewing company. All right, Lynn, well, what do you reckon?
On with the show! One thing to do while in the Tumut area is visit the Blowering Dam. Now, this dam is famous as the site of the world water speed records back in 1978. Blowering Dam is one of the biggest dams in New South Wales, with a capacity of 1,628,000 megalitres, or three times the size of Sydney Harbour.
Now, hang on, Lynn. Three times the size of Sydney Harbour?
Ah, yes, that's correct, Phil.
Okay, all right. Continue.
Thank you. Blowering Dam stores water and it's released upstream for electricity generation in the Snowy Mountains hydroelectric scheme and releases water for the agriculture in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area. The large reservoir is popular for water sports and a recreation destination. Now, you can walk across the dam wall for spectacular valley and forest views north towards Tumut and views south to the rugged bushland of Kosciuszko National Park. The dam's rock wall is 747 metres long and 114 metres high.
Wow.
It's impressive. And there is also a walking track to Blowering Falls. The dam is 13 kilometres south of Tumut.
Well, Linny, I've got to say, all this talk of water has inspired me to play a song.
And who will that be, Phil?
That will be none other than Richard Clapton.
Yes, and what's the song's title?
The song title? What else would it be? But Deep Water. We'll be back with more Roman Oz straight after Deep Water.
Go down to the beach at night. Fireflies dancing in the promenade lights. All those rock and roll bands used to really swing. And I'd do the foxtrot with sweet Christine, speaking to me with a gentle hand. Fly on down to Wonderland. Deep water. Deep water.
sitting out on the Palm Beach Road. I'm so drunk and the car won't go. My crazy eyes keep looking out to sea. The Sunday drivers are cruising round. Wish they'd all go back to town. What do they expect to find?
Richard Clapton, what a great song, Deep Water. Now, what are you going to tell us all about next, Lynn?
Well, we're going to take a visit to the Adelong Falls gold mine ruins. Now, you can walk around this state-listed heritage industrial site, and it's only 1.5 kilometres out of Adelong and 20 minutes from Tumut. Now, the interpretive area has a comprehensive history of the site with a viewing platform that is also wheelchair-friendly and is accessible from the lower car park for those that won't want to walk. You can walk around the ruins taking about an hour. Now, it's signposted along the route describing various items relating to the site. The stone ruins of the reefer ore crushing machine was built by Scotsmen and still remains for all to see from the viewing platform. Or wander through to interpret how reef ore was processed. This mill processed ore from mines along Adeline and the wider district and ceased operation back in 1914. The falls are popular in the warmer months and a great spot for walking and picnics. Now, also while in Adelong, visit the Adelong Alive Museum. It tells the stories of Adelong and the district, beginning with the Gold Rush period of 1852 through to present day. This small museum offers a variety of local displays and other exhibits which are rotated regularly. The museum is open weekends from 11 to 1 and is a gold coin donation.
Oh, and look, speaking about gold, and you know how much I love my Aussie music, Lynn.
Yes, that's correct.
Can I play a song now called Gold Rush Country by Slim Dusty?
Yep, sounds perfect.
All right, listeners, well, stick around. Gold Rush Country, Slim Dusty, and we'll be back with more Roman Oz straight after that.
Gold Rush Country, Gold Rush Country, recall the name and stake your claim in Gold Rush Country. In Gold Rush Country, Nickel Strike Country, scene of the Golden Mile. Or a Bander and Coolgardy, pioneers were hardy when gold strikes were in style. Leonora to the north, Norseman to the south, and Southern Cross westward many a mile. In Gold Rush Country, Nickel Strike Country, scene of the Golden Mile. In this big wide western country, there's a vein of gold fever going round. There's a wealth of old-time stories of gold rush and bygone glories, of fortunes that were made, fortunes that were lost, and fortunes still to find. In Gold Rush Country, Nickel Strike Country,
scene of the Golden Mile. In this big white golden country, surrounding old Kalgoorlie town, there's the old time pomp and glory. You can be part of their story. In fortunes that were made, fortunes that were lost, and fortunes still to find. In gold rush country, nickel strike country, scene of the Golden Mile. Gold rush country, gold rush country, recall the name and stake your claim in gold rush country. Recall the name and stake your claim in gold rush country. In gold rush country.
What a great song that was, Gold Rush by Slim Dusty. Now, I'm sure in his travels around Australia, he would have visited this town. Now, it's the township of Batlow on the edge of the Great Dividing Range, 775 metres above sea level. Now, Batlow is known for its apples, with around 50 growers in the district supplying 1.6 million cases of apples, or 10% of Australia's apple crop, to the Australian market. Stop in and see some of the local farmers selling fresh produce at the gate. Now, Hume and Hovell were the first Europeans to explore the area back in 1824. Gold was then discovered back in 1854, and a small settlement called Reedy Creek was established. Now, the gold deposits were quickly exhausted, but farmers found the area was better suited to a variety of crops. Reedy Creek was later renamed to Batlow in 1889.
Now, what sort of crops are we talking about here, Lynn?
Well, we're talking about fruit trees and timber. They became the main source of income, and in 1910, the town site was gazetted. In 1922, the first cool stores in New South Wales were constructed, and also the railway was built in Tumut, which helped the town's trade with Sydney and beyond, and even supplying the troops with dehydrated fruit and vegetables during World War II.
Now, that reminds me of a song, Lynn. Another song. How amazing is it that everything you tell us reminds me of a song?
Yes. And now, who are we playing?
Well, I think this one's probably not been played by anybody. I've not heard it before. It is a great song, though, and it is called Goodbye, Aussie Farmer.
And who sings that?
Well, it is, of course, Tanya and her brother Greg Kernaghan.
Oh, well, let's listen to it, Phil.
And we're going to bring it up right now, listeners, and straight after that, yes, we'll be back with more Roamin' Oz.
From beneath the dusty brow he peers out across forever, puts a callous, well-worn hand upon the wheel he knows so well. As he fires that Fergie up, he sends a silent prayer to heaven. We both know he needs a little help. God, give him what you can. Is it goodbye, Aussie farmer, the one who's done us proud? He never looked for handouts, just a chance to work it out. Wish we had stood beside you when the chips were really down. Is it goodbye, Aussie farmer? Do you pack it off to town?
Banks and politicians know so little of the land. Though they calculate and talk as if they understand, watch the backbone of this country break while they smile and shake your hand. Inherit what's left over, sell to foreign hands. Is it goodbye or is it farming? One who's done us proud. You never look for handouts, just a chance to work it out. Wish we had stood beside you when chips were really down. Is it goodbye? You pack it off to town.
We say, what can I do? And does it matter anyhow? If what we eat and wear and use is not from Aussie ground, well, it matters to our children, those left to carry on. Wish all it took to make a change was hard work, rain and sun. Is it goodbye, Aussie farmer, the one who's done us proud? You never look for handouts, just a chance to work it out. Wish we had stood beside you when the chips were really down. Is it goodbye, Aussie farmer?
Is it goodbye, Aussie farmer, the one who's done us proud? You never look a handout, just a chance to work it out. Wish we had stood beside you when the chips were really down. Is it goodbye, Aussie farmer?
Do you pack it off to town?
Don't say goodbye, Aussie farmer.
God knows we need you now.
Now, Phil, I think it's about time you told us some interesting information. So how about I send you off to the Tumut Broom Factory for something different?
The Broom Factory?
Yes, and visit Robert Richards.
All right, Lynn, if that's what you'd like me to do, I'll chuff on down to the Tumut Broom Factory and have a quick chat there with Robert Richards.
Welcome back, listeners. You're with Phil C on Roman Oz, and here we are at the Tumut Broom Factory, and I'm chatting with Robert Richards. How are you today, Robert?
Yeah, I'm good, Phil. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Yep,
fantastic, fantastic. Tell us all about your business, because these brooms, they're all handmade, and they're the old-style millet broom. I call them a witch's broom. Tell us a little bit about the brooms.
Well, they're a millet broom.
Yep.
People call them straw brooms or whatever, you know, but... I'd worked here 48 years ago, and what we do today is still very similar to what we did 48 years ago, you know,
right,
how
yep.
they're all made. They're all made by hand.
Uh-huh.
The millet is wound around the handle.
Right.
There's different layers inside the broom.
Yes.
You start off putting a centre layer. There's several different types of brooms we make. We make a woolshed broom, which we put a bit of cane in the centre of it.
Right.
So it makes it a harder, stiffer broom.
Yes, okay.
But an all millet broom, which is your traditional type broom that you can use indoor and out.
Uh-huh.
That's just all millet.
Right.
So you start off putting the centre layer,
right.
which we call the guts layers.
Yes.
And you put that on in three different parts, which creates a flat side.
Right.
Then you put an inside hurl. Hurl's just a name given to the millet once it's taken off the stalk, because millet grows like corn. It grows on its whole stalk.
Right.
And once the fibre's been taken off the stalk, they call it hurl.
Right.
So... Okay. You put the inside hurl on,
mm-hmm.
which is put on in two halves.
Right.
It's put on backwards, then turned over. And then you've got to pound that back tight against the first layer and straighten it all out. And then you'd go to the last layer of hurl.
Okay.
And, it's one of those manual processes and takes a while to learn.
Okay. And who taught you? Did you start out as an apprentice like 48 years ago?
Well, you wouldn't call it an apprentice.
Yep.
You started here when I first left school at 14. We used to live up around the corner here, and I used to come down here before I actually left school and do a few hours in the afternoon, you know, doing cutting strings and that sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then when I left school, I come down here and started off on the floor, cutting strings, putting labels on, doing all those sort of things.
Yep.
And then if you're willing to have a go at learning to make a broom,
yes,
you'd be put on one of the machines, because back then there was four wooden machines driven off a belt system like the old shoe shed set up.
Yes.
And you started off making a little hand whisk.
Right.
And you worked your way up, making a bit bigger broom, yep, until you got to the proper price. And then once you got used to making the broom, you went on to piecework. Just like a shearer, you got paid for the quantity of brooms you made.
So how long does it take to make a broom, one broom from start to finish?
Oh, nowadays, 5 or 6 minutes.
Oh, wow, okay. Well,
that's just putting the broom together.
Okay.
That's not stitching it up and all that sort of stuff. Right. And prior to that, too, there's a bit of work involved in the millet.
Right.
Nowadays, we have to use imported millet.
Okay. So where does the millet come from?
It comes from Mexico.
Okay.
We have to import it because years ago, in its heyday around Chermit here, they grew 800 tonne or more a year.
Wow, okay.
Which is approximately around 1,600 acres worth. And millet they grew was a white Italian variety.
Right.
And it'll grow anything from 2 metres to 4 metres tall.
So how do you harvest that? You cut it right off of the ground, or
No. It's a very, very labour-intensive crop.
Right.
So when it's ready to harvest, you've got to table it.
Uh-huh.
Which means you've got to walk backwards down the rows.
Uh-huh.
And you grab half dozen stalks at a time.
Yes.
You push, bend it backwards at hip height.
Yes.
And push it down at the same time, so you're folding the stalk over at hip height.
Right.
And on your right hand side, you do that. Then you'd fold that to the left.
Right.
Then you grab the row of millet on the left-hand side and do the same, bend it over,
yes,
and you'd fold that to the right. So you'd be crisscrossing it,
right,
walking backwards, so it forms a table where you're crossing the stalks over.
Okay, yes.
Forms a table.
Yep.
So you'd have to go along the table as much as you were going to cut that day, and then you've got to walk along with a little hand knife, no bigger than a pocket knife, and you've got to individually cut each head off.
Oh, my goodness. So that's very labour-intensive.
Very labour-intensive crop harvest. And there's a lot more working than that, too.
Uh-huh.
And then the broom factories would buy it all from the farmers by weight, by bale.
Right.
And back when we were buying local millet, we'd have to grade it all.
Okay,
all right. And to give you an idea, to grade 100 kilo bale of millet, take you all day.
Right, okay.
And you lose 20% of that in waste.
Right, okay.
So when we order the imported millet,
yes,
we order it already graded.
Right.
So we do a bit to it, but we don't have to do that full process.
The full process, okay. Yeah. Now, what about the handles? The handles are all Australian?
The handles are, the ones we're using at the moment are Tasmanian ash or oak, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
Porter Mouldings in Melbourne, Dalemount.
Uh-huh.
They're a nice handle.
Right.
Hardwood handle.
Mm-hmm.
We have looked at a few other different varieties of handles.
Yes.
We'd like to stick to the Australian-made one.
Yep.
But we'll just have to see how the future goes with that.
I understand.
Yep.
I understand. And what about the building we're in? It's a very old. It dates back to the 1800s, is that right?
No. It's only, I think it must have been second-hand iron and that they put on after the war.
Right.
Because this was built. This building's only ever been a broom factory.
Right. When did the broom factory open?
1946, I think it was.
Okay, right.
All the farmers around here, most of them were dairy farmers,
uh-huh,
to subsidise their dairy, and they grew millet.
Right.
And back in those days, there was up to 14 broom factories in Australia.
Right. Traditional millet broom factories,
yeah,
up
millet
to 14.
Broom factories, 14 of them.
Yep.
And they'd send that millet on to Sydney, that they grew around here, and it'd be auctioned off in Sydney.
Okay.
And the farmers thought, instead of just growing millet and selling it, let's form a co-op
and
make
brooms
as well. And that's how this building got built, and they formed a co-op, and it started off like that. And that was a run fairly strong for a lot of years.
Yes.
Like I said, when I've worked here 48 years ago, there were still 10 people working here, and we used to do probably 400 brooms a day.
Right.
And there were still, up to 14 broom factories still going too.
Wow. So now there's only you and your son in here at the moment. Do you have other staff that work with you?
Yeah. Jeffrey Wirtz, he actually owns the building.
Yep.
He's away today, and his son's working here too, which have been teaching him how to make a broom.
Right.
Jeffrey does the stitching up of the brooms. Jeffrey owns a building. His father worked here as a broom maker when he was younger. Then he became the manager of the building, of the factory. And when the cooperative failed, he bought it at auction and kept it going with a few people, but he passed away 12 years or more ago now, and so Jeffrey owns the building now, and we're just equal partners in the business.
And obviously your son's going to take over in your footsteps?
My son and his son, hopefully.
Hopefully. And yeah, we'll still be making millet brooms.
Millet brooms, that's right.
In another 100 years' time, yeah, hopefully. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for your time, Richard. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. Very interesting, very informative. And I would recommend to anybody travelling through Tumut to call in and see Richard and have a look. And quite welcome for people to just come in and have a look at how you manufacture the brooms. And
yep, no problems, Phil.
All right, Robert. I said Richard. It's actually Robert Richards, isn't it? I got it back to front.
Yep.
Fantastic. All right, Robert. Well, thank you so much for your time. Now, I'm going to play a song for you, but as all my listeners know, it's got to be Aussie. And you're an Aussie, so who's your favourite Aussie band?
Oh, let's go Akadaka and Jailbreak.
Akadaka's Jailbreak. You don't look like the sort of man. He's a broommaker, listeners, but he loves his Akadaka. Stick around for more Roman Oz straight after this.
Was a friend of mine on murder, and the judge's gavel fell. Jury found him guilty, gave him 16 years in hell. He said, I ain't spending my life here, I ain't living alone, ain't breaking no rocks from the chain gang, I'm breaking out and heading home. I'm gonna make a change.
Yeah.
Oh, well, welcome back, listeners. This is Phil C, and I'm still Roman Oz. And today I'm with Tim Martin, Managing Director of Tumut River Brewing Company. How are you today, Tim?
I'm good, thanks, mate. I'm excited to be here.
So am I.
If the only thing we've got to do is get a couple of beers.
Exactly, exactly. But I'll tell you what, we're going to try a few of your brews afterwards, okay? Sometimes I have to sing for my supper, and today I'm going to have to sing for a beer.
I just feel odd having a conversation with anybody without a beer in my hand these days. I've gotten so used to that being the process. If you see me doing this, see me doing this a little bit, though, you know that I think I'm hanging on to a beer. It'll make me feel more comfortable.
Fantastic. Righto, Tim. Now, tell us a bit about your brewing company. How long have you been doing it, and why did you do it? How did it all start up?
Yeah, so that's obviously, this interview is not going to be the kind of interview we can go through the whole story.
No.
So basically, the short version is I saw a need for commercial tourism in Tumut.
Yes.
So the interest in beer was actually an interest in developing commercial tourism for the region and trying to do something that could sustain itself. The biggest, in my opinion, everything is my opinion in this, so you'll have to bear with me on that.
Uh-huh.
But in my opinion, one of the biggest issues that we had with commercial tourism efforts in the past have been that none of them were big enough to sustain themselves. So they'd do something lovely, but we didn't have the trade and they couldn't generate the trade, so they inevitably failed because they didn't have enough traffic.
Okay.
I was looking to do something large enough to be able to sustain itself and hopefully allow other smaller ventures to sort of feed off it,
right,
in the hopes of turning around Tumut's tourism.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of idea you come up with when you're 27, because you think you can change the world and everything's going to be, you can do anything you want.
Yes.
As a 40-plus-year-old now, it's been a long, hard road, and yeah, I often want to kick the 27-year-old version of Tim.
Okay.
But, yeah, we're pushing through it. So that's kind of where the original inspiration came about. And then I came across the idea of a craft brewery.
Right.
So originally I had sort of no intention of to what it was going to be. I just knew I wanted to do something like that.
Yes.
And a craft brewery ticked all the boxes because it was something that was manufactured locally. It was craft and artisanal. It had the live music aspect. It had the hospitality component. So for me, it would build a great venue to allow us to provide all of those things. The thing I hadn't anticipated was falling in love with brewing.
Right.
So that's part of the process.
Right.
I had to learn how to brew beer, and I became absolutely obsessed with brewing beer.
Yes.
So when the original concept all fell in a heap and we had to walk away from it, I was then an addicted home brewer that then came full circle and opened a brewery anyway.
Right.
So it's sort of so I've managed to meet my first and second level goals,
uh-huh,
within the one project, because they changed so dramatically between when I started and when I got here.
Right.
So that was, yeah, like I said, it's been a long time to get, uh-huh, to this point. And yeah, it was about 8 years ago now, started building the original brewery.
Right.
The original brewery was a 150-litre brew house, so we were the smallest commercial microbrewery in the Southern Hemisphere.
Right.
And that cost about $60,000 to get open, to basically produce beer legally.
Yes.
And that was just basically effectively savings and desperate pleas for money from my wife and my parents and so on and so forth.
But you do have a partner, don't you? Because the story is like two mates, one beer. So.
Yeah, so we did. We wanted. I did have a partner.
Mm-hmm.
He had a family and decided that this working 80 hours to 100 hours a week and being away every weekend and not being home of an evening and not getting paid was not the ideal situation for a young marriage and a baby.
Yes.
So he made the decision to spend more time at home. So he's now got he's still got a small share in the brewery, just in case Tui's comes and buys us one day for $150 million.
Okay.
And he'll get paid for all the years' effort he put in before he left.
Right.
But other than that, it's basically just me now. So yeah, he was here in the beginning and he helped me definitely with the construction and providing an extra bit of motivation when things were tough.
Right.
So yes, I know, it was good.
So yeah, we were talking earlier and you said you've got to go, like tomorrow morning at 4:30 a.m. you've got to go to Canberra and start doing deliveries.
Yeah, yeah.
So you
yeah.
really are doing 80 hours a week, 100
yeah,
hours.
Well, so
yeah,
well, yeah, I guess an average day for me. So in the theory for me is that I work Monday to Friday,
right,
because I'm in management, let's call it, in the business.
Uh-huh.
So I am the brewer as well. So the theory is I work from 6 a.m. Monday to Friday till between 6 and 10 p.m. depending on just what's going on here, like because if there's an event I have to be here for it or whatever, or if the brew goes bad, then I'm often here later to try and make sure it comes out okay at the end.
Right.
And then the catch is that I do the tours because I'm the person who knows the story.
Right.
I do the festivals and I do the farmers markets because I'm free.
Yes.
And those things don't often make money.
Mm-hmm.
So often weekends I'm away as well. So okay. That's the challenge. So I try to only travel 8 to 10 months of the year,
mm-hmm.
so that I then have at least sort of ideally one weekend off a month if I can where I'm at home. And so that's kind of my fantasy, and that's what I try to stick to. Well, okay. Actually, the fantasy is every weekend. The reality is probably about one out of every month.
Okay.
Yeah, and then obviously there's one day a week I travel. So that one day a week I get up at about 3:30, 4 o'clock, and then I hit the road, and if I'm lucky, I'm home before midnight. And I do about 1,200 kilometres on that trip.
Wow.
And just go and do all the deliveries.
1,200 kilometres in one day? Yeah. Doing all your deliveries?
Yeah, yeah. So it's just, again... You're not allowed to ask staff to do that.
No.
But as a business owner, you're allowed to do whatever you want.
Of course.
So the practicality aspect of it is I can't afford to be on the road more than one day.
Yes.
And nobody can do that run unless they're the owner.
Yes.
Because of the sheer amount of hours you have to
do. Of course.
So we either send somebody away for two or I just take one and get it done. So yeah. I'm pretty grumpy on Thursdays. Thursdays is not a good day to come and visit me.
Fair enough.
Wednesdays is usually the better day. Wednesdays is my hard day.
So where do you deliver to? Other than Canberra, you 1,200 kilometres, your beer must be sort of everywhere now.
Oh, look, it's getting that way. It's funny because 1,200 kilometres isn't as far as you think by the time you do a whole loop.
Right.
So on that day is Canberra, South Coast and ski fields.
Okay.
So I will go through Canberra, down the South Coast and then up back through the ski fields, mm-hmm. and then I'll get home. So I've got to time my venues right because the last venue I visit is about 10 o'clock.
Right.
So I've got to try and... So the first venues I visit are always Woolworths and distributors and stuff. We've got warehouses that are open early. So mm-hmm. when I get to Canberra, they're already open. I drop off my stock to those guys. Then I work my way through the ones through the middle of the day and then I end up at the end with restaurants and bars that are open till late, and that way I can sort of meet each area as I go through at the right time.
Right.
And that's had a bit of a challenge last week. I decided to shake my route up and went the other way, and I ended up having to stay in Canberra. Because by the time I got there, I missed half the venues. You know what I mean? The idea was to avoid the... was to come the two-hour drive down the Hume rather than coming the two-hour drive through the Kangaroos and Brumbies.
Mm-hmm.
And the catch was that I miscalculated my venues, so the venues that I ended up at were closed, so I had to wait till the next day.
So now what about your beers? How many do you actually make? How many different brews have you got?
So we make 12 at any one time.
Okay.
So the idea, we have six, which is actually now seven,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost becoming eight, which is a problem because we keep getting carried away. But we have a minimum of six staples at the minute.
Right.
And like I said, there's two extras there that seem to keep making their way in, even though they're not technically staples.
Right.
And then we brew our seasonals on top of that. So the idea is that out of our 24 taps, we always try to have 12 of our own.
Yep.
And then we have another 12 that are other local ciders, local independent breweries. You know, basically anything that ticks those boxes gets the opportunity to be on our wall.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of how we try to keep it. It's been 7 years of trade, 8 years since we started building the brewery.
Right.
And so I've made hundreds of different beers now.
Okay.
It's gotten to the point now where it's getting a bit insane. But it's good fun. Like that's the, you know, making the Hitchhikers every day, making the Ginger Ninja every day, that's work.
Yes.
But like making, we just made one called Just Beer.
Yes.
And it's literally for the bloke who comes up and goes, I just want a beer.
Okay.
You know, just give me a beer. And we go, well, this is just beer.
Okay.
And so that was basically a Kolsch style, but I hadn't made a Kolsch before, which is, you know, quite a common beer. I just never made one. So
right.
I made one this time. So that's fun because it's a new recipe and it's something different. And I get to experiment a little bit. We just brought off a Blood Orange Sour. So that's another one which we've done a couple of times before with Dalgetty. They're one of our friends in the brewing world,
mm-hmm.
and they often work with us with some different beers, so we do a few different collaborations with them.
Yes.
And so they came down this time and we made that one again. That was great fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so there's a always something new.
Tours. Oh yeah, now tell us about your tours.
Yeah, yeah. So we do the tours. The tours are booked on the website.
Right.
And so we just are, like, they're basically, there's different price structures, which I don't even remember what they are. But the basic crux is there is a very basic tour that we do for groups, which is just the actual tour itself.
Yep.
And then for individuals, we do different levels of the tour, one with just tasters, one with tasters and a meal. But the tour itself is always the same. And in that process, you generally get me, unless I'm just not able to be here because of other events like we were talking about earlier.
Yep.
But I'll then take you through the history of the brewery, like how we started and the trials and tribulations we went through to get here.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go through the brewing process itself.
Okay.
And how we make it and what ingredients we use. And a lot of, I mean, if we've got a group of just a couple who are specifically together on their own tour, then they can steer the thing however they like.
Mm-hmm.
Like quite often we'll get home brewers that'll just book my time and then we'll spend the whole time talking about his home brew process.
Okay.
How to get, you know, then how to get a better
hop
utilization, yep, or how to get rid of dissolved oxygen or whatever it might be that he's trying to, or she is trying to work their way through.
Okay.
So that's, yeah, it's obviously pretty flexible, but the whole thing usually takes about an hour, hour and a half.
Okay.
And it just goes through everything to do with us. And so hopefully they come out liking us more,
okay,
rather than less.
I love to have a beer with Duncan. I love to have a beer with Duncan. We drink in moderation and we never, ever, ever get rolling drunk. We drink at the town and country where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Duncan, 'cause Duncan's me mate, yeah. I love to have a beer with Colin. I love to have a beer with Colin. We drink in moderation and it doesn't really matter if he brings his doll. We drink at the town and country where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Colin, 'cause Colin's me mate. I love to have a beer with Kevin. Oh, I love to have a beer with Kev. We drink in moderation and he drives me home in his big old ship. We drink at the town and country where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Kevin, 'cause Kevin's me mate. I love to have a beer with Patrick. I love to have a beer with Pat. We drink in moderation and it wouldn't really matter if the beer was flat. We drink at the town and country where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Patrick, 'cause Patrick's me mate. Change key. I love to have a beer with Robert. I love to have a beer with Bob. We drink in moderation, just one more and back on the job. We drink at the town and country where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Robert, 'cause Robert's me mate. I love to have a beer with Duncan. Oh, I love to have a beer with Duncan. We drink in moderation and we never, ever, ever get rolling drunk. We drink at the town and country where the atmosphere is great. I love to have a beer with Duncan, 'cause Duncan's me mate. I love to have a beer with Duncan, 'cause Duncan's me mate.
One more.
Oh, that was an appropriate song, Phil. I want to have a beer with Duncan, and
yes,
that was a great chat you had with Tim at the brewery.
He's such a nice fella, isn't he?
Yes, really, he was.
What a great guy. And you know what? Speaking about great guys, I've kept one of the greatest ones to last because we didn't mention this right at the start of the program.
No,
but
what's that?
I'm actually chatting to Richie. Do you know Richie from the Skydive Oz?
No, I can't say I've met him.
Oh, well.
Skydiving's not my thing.
No, I know. You're a bit frightened about heights and so on and so forth. But Richie said that anybody from 12 to 90 or even beyond can jump out of a plane.
So I've got a chance then to still do it.
Richie's a professional. He's the chief instructor at Skydive Oz, and he tells me that he can get anybody smiling and laughing and wanting to do it again. So you know what? I'm going to chat with him right now.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Let's do it. All right, our listeners, well, this is Phil C, and we're still roaming Oz, and I have got Richie from Skydive Oz. How are you going today, Rich?
I'm going very good, Phil. Yourself?
Mate, I'm having a ball, and I want to find out all about your business because a lot of my listeners, they could be interested in doing some skydiving in the not-too-distant future, and I understand that your company, Skydive Oz, or the company you work for, you're doing tours at the moment. You're going all around the country. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's correct. So, look, we're based on the lower south coast of New South Wales. So then pretty much how many times we're doing it this year, I think we've got, you know, between 4 to 8 to 10 towns that we're going out back.
Right.
So it's just a good way for us to take skydiving to, you know, to people who can't get to the coast, where it's not as accessible. So we load the plane up with instructors and pilots and packers and all that stuff. And, yeah, we set off in the plane to these regional towns. We park up for either a day or two, depending on the numbers that we have. And, yeah, we just like bringing skydiving to the regional towns and showing them what we're all about.
Unbelievable. So how long have you guys been operating like this?
The tours have been happening pretty much since the company started, I think about 12 or 13 years ago. The boss actually started his skydiving, teaching people to actually jump out at, I think, Moree and places like that.
Right.
So then he ended up moving down to the coast here.
Okay. So when you say South Coast, you're located sort of around the Batemans Bay area, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
About half an hour south.
All righty. Now, tell us, like, I've never jumped out of a plane. I'm a pretty courageous sort of a guy, and I've done abseiling. I've never bungee jumped because I think, why would I want to throw myself off a cliff with a rubber band attached to my ankle? Skydiving's been something I've always thought, you know, I was actually just discussing this with my partner the other day, and I said, yeah, I'd give skydiving a crack. You know, you got a professional that you're sort of attached to, and he's got a couple of parachutes. You've got a couple of parachutes. It's not like bungee jumping with a rubber band tied around your ankle. What's it like? Well, I mean, what are the people that have done it for the very first time? Do they sort of come down shaking and trembling, or is it all just this one big, incredible adrenaline rush where it's just like, oh my God, I can't wait to do that again? What's it like?
Most of the shaking and all that kind of stuff happens prior to them getting in the plane. That's probably where they're the most nervous, I'd find. It's the whole gearing up and them coming to terms with what they're doing. Once they actually hop in the plane and start to fly around and just see everything from above, they most of the time start to calm down.
Right.
They definitely get a bit nervous again once that 4 minute comes and we start gearing them up and running them through what they have to do.
Yes.
And then, honestly, yeah, for sure, when that door opens, their eyes are like dinner plates and they're pretty awake. But once they're out, mate, they're loving it.
They're loving it.
Yeah, like I said, it's very, very rare that you'll come down and someone will say, I won't do that again.
Okay.
You know, it's a unique experience. It's something that's very hard to explain what it's like,
right.
You know, doing a couple of hundred Ks an hour.
Yes.
From about four Ks up in the sky is a pretty unique thing to do. So, it's a great feeling.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, once they're out in free fall, they're just more enjoying it than actually freaking out about it.
Okay.
No, it's a brilliant experience. I was hooked at the first hand, and that's for sure.
Really? So, Richie, you're the chief instructor, is that correct?
Yeah, yes.
You're the chief instructor. So how long have you been skydiving?
I started in October 2009.
Okay.
Same thing. I started doing a tandem.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it would lead me to this position.
Yes.
Funny enough, here I am many years later.
Wow.
But I just did the course after that.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm over 7,500 jumps later.
Right.
In, you know, 11 or so years. And yeah, it's been a pretty cool journey. It's taken me all around the world, doing world competitions and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's been a pretty cool journey for sure.
Fantastic. So, what would be the youngest person that you personally have ever had as a tandem diving person with you? The youngest that comes to mind.
The youngest I've taken is 12 years old.
Okay, and the oldest.
Yep.
What would be the oldest you've had?
I think the most eldest I've taken would be about 93 or 94.
Wow. Okay, so it's for all ages, from 12 years to 90.
It is for all ages, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yep, for sure, and I think, yeah, some people over 100 years old have jumped as well. So.
My God, okay. So does it take a special kind? Have you got to have this real thrill-seeking passion, or is it just something that pretty much anybody could do? Like from 12 to 90, I mean, that's a huge age range. I mean, I'm thinking, like, I was talking to my partner about this just yesterday, and I thought, you know, I could probably do this. And she looked at me with dinner plates in her eyes and said, so you throw yourself out of a plane. And I went, well, it's not like I'm going to throw myself out of a plane. I mean, I got a parachute. I'm with a professional. We're strapped up together. It's, you know, it's not like I'm just going to jump off a cliff with a rubber band around my ankle. I think skydiving for me would be easier to do than bungee jumping. And it's a lot higher
it
up
is.
There.
Well, I think it is for sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
For sure. We've got more time. When you're doing bungee jumping, you've got to jump yourself. You're lower to the ground, whereas once you sort of get above the 6,000-7,000 feet mark, your eyes can't tell the difference with the height. So they're just like, that's a long way. We'll deal with it after.
Okay.
But and we're kind of doing all the work as the instructor, whereas bungee jumping, you know, you've got to jump yourself. But as the passenger, you're just literally do a couple of things you've got to remember, and if you don't remember that, it's not too much of a bigger deal. As the instructors that we have, we can deal with all those situations. It's pretty much just put a smile on your face and enjoy it.
Now, I understand you also do, because in some of your packages, I've had a look at your website there, some of your packages you can do a jump, you can have it like videoed, or your whole experience. Is that correct?
Yes, for sure. So, yeah, we had some video. I think you can get photos or video and photos. So that's where the instructor will have a handy cam glove on with a GoPro in it.
Yes.
And we'll, do a series of clips or a series of, I think when we do photos, you'll get around 300 photos from the start to the finish. Or at the end of it, you could have a nice edited video package to go with it as well. So no, it's always rememberable because most people on their first jump tend to go, that was over quick. So to have the video there, it's nice to remind them there that it did go a little bit longer in the free fall and all that kind of stuff, because most people are like, that felt like 10 seconds.
Yes.
But no, it was probably maybe more like 40 seconds up to a minute. So, and I was the same as well. I was like, that was over way too quick.
So from the time you actually jump out of the plane to the time you land on the ground, how long does it take? Because you said you were up, like, how high are you up when you do this? What's the height?
Oh, so we'll go generally minimum of about 12,000 feet. It's obviously pending on weather factors and some other things like that. But anywhere between 12,000 to 14,000 feet. So with that, you're looking on an average between 50 seconds to a minute of free fall around there.
Yes.
And then once we open the parachute at about 5,000 to 5,500 feet.
Right.
And then you'll have a nice leisurely three to four minute parachute flight until we land.
Wow. Okay. Fantastic.
So, four to five minutes.
4 to 5 minutes. Sounds like a lot of fun. I think it'd be an awesome time. Now, what about these tours you're talking about? Have you got any actual towns that you're going to be visiting in the next, in the next few weeks or in the next month that you'd like to mention for any of the listeners? Where you're going to be? What towns? What dates?
So I guess coming up soon in July, we're going to Tumut on the 24th of July.
Right.
And then to Cowra on the 31st of July.
Right.
We have some other ones, like we're spread out pretty much until November. Mm-hmm. We're also going to Cobar. We're going to Bourke, Narromine on the 28th of August, Parkes on the 18th of September.
Right.
And then after that, we're Lightning Ridge on the 4th of November.
Wow. Okay.
Moree on the 6th of November and Narrabri on the 7th of November. So the closest one will be Tumut.
Yes.
They're good fun, I can tell you. It's great fun getting out to the country and doing some jumps out there for sure.
Well, mate, this sounds fantastic. And, we're at Tumut right at the moment, which is what made me think of you. And I thought, well, when you guys are out there, I hope that a lot of my listeners decide to look you up. Where are you going to be in Tumut? If you, have you got an actual location, or what's the best way for the listeners to find out where you're going to be? Obviously, your website, or how do they go about it in the various different regional country towns?
Our website would be the best place to make contact, and that will have our contact details there. So that's just Skydive. Just look up Skydive Oz.
Yes. Okay.
Or you can even email us at fun@skydiveoz.com.au.
Okay.
And you can just put some inquiries into where we're going to be and find out some more details. and go from there. Hopefully all those listeners get involved with it because you'll love it, I guarantee.
Sounds like you're going to have a ball, Richie. You know, the idea of throwing yourself out of a plane with somebody else attached to you, you've been doing it a long time, you know what you're doing, and you've been doing it overseas as well. So it sounds like you've picked the job that was definitely, designed for you, my friend.
For sure. I like to think so as well.
Good on you, Richie. Thank you so much for your time, mate. And I hope a lot of my listeners, because as we said, listeners from 12 to the into the 90s, and these guys are highly professional. They know what they're doing, and you have no fear. You're just going to come back with lots of big smiles on your faces and tell all your friends, hey, I jumped out of a plane the other day with Richie. Mate, thank you
so much.
That's
the plan for sure.
Buddy, I'm going to have to play a song for you now. What's your favourite Aussie band or song I can play for you for taking some time to chat with me today?
Oh, I'd have to say a good one that comes to mind would have to be In Excess, Phil, and Mystify.
Great stuff. All right, listeners, we'll stick around for In Excess's Mystify.
All veils and misty, streets are blue. Almond looks that chill divine. Some silken moment goes on forever, and we're leaving broken hearts behind. Mystify me. Mystify me. I need perfection, some twisted selection that tangles me to keep me alive in all that exists. When none has your beauty, I will survive. Mystify me. Mystify me. Eternally wild with the power to make every moment come alive. All the stars to shine.
Hope you enjoyed the show, listeners.
If you missed any, check out our Facebook page or allaussieradio.com.au.
Tune in next week for more Roman Oz.